You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, April 21st, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, national correspondent for Time Magazine, Charlotte Alter, on the ones we've been waiting for, how a new generation of leaders transform America. Also on the program today, Trump seeks to suspend immigration, ban green cards and visas. Meanwhile, red states plan to open up within days, at least partially. And also meanwhile, the vast majority of the country think the anti-lockdown protests are a joke and don't want to open up the country yet. Smithfield Processing defends its processing plant procedures and blames the COVID-19 cluster on cultural differences. Meanwhile, in Iowa, the National Guard is mobilized to protect its plants from cultural differences. Florida's unemployment regime failing catastrophically. Amazon-owned Whole Foods using heat maps to foil organizing by its workers as hundreds of Amazon workers stage a sick-out. AOC announces she will vote against the next bailout package. The question is, will more progressives follow? Trump administration denies college students SNAP waivers, leaving up to tens of thousands without food assistance. Oil prices go negative. Yes, negative dollars. And everybody's wondering, is Kim Jong-un near death? Trump's coronavirus task force now largely ignoring Trump. And a new study shows viewership of Sean Hannity versus Tucker Carlson correlates with a 20% increase in coronavirus deaths. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, folks. Pleasure to have you here. Thanks for joining us. We got a busy day. Let's get right into this. Hope everyone is safe and doing well. Let's pick up on some of this sound. As I mentioned at the in the headlines, we have multiple states now are reopening. Yesterday, Brian Kemp from Georgia announced that gyms, hair salons, and other businesses can reopen on Friday in Georgia. They must adhere to social distancing guidelines and meet other safety standards. Good luck with that. Tennessee Governor Bill Lee said he would not be extending the state stay-at-home order, which expires April 30th. That is in 9 days. So next Monday, there will be some businesses allowed to open as on Monday. In South Carolina, Governor Henry McMaster issued an executive order to reopen public beaches and allow some retail businesses to reopen beginning Monday with social distancing rules. And Greg Abbott announced, of course, last week that some retail businesses will open up this Friday, though schools will remain closed. It's going to be an interesting next couple of weeks, folks, because this is all geared towards creating pressure on blue states so that Donald Trump has someone to blame for the economic woes when they open up late, according to him. We shall see. In the meantime, there is this broad attempt by the right in this country to deny the reality of this virus. And, you know, the bottom line is you can say, let's kill Granny. Who cares about Granny? As if that was all that was at stake here. As if killing Granny was just, what are you going to do? As if, like, we just would regularly, you know, be willing to sacrifice our elderly. Which is in no way to imply that those are the only people who are in danger here. But, I mean, it's just sort of bizarre, the cavalier way that people are, let's just kill Granny. But also the delusion that that's the way it works. That we can just all go about our business and it's just mostly going to be Granny. It's insane. It's insanity. Here is Brian Kilmeade desperately trying to get anyone to agree with him. Oh, I know, say the producers. Let's invite on a doctor who will just say anything to get back onto our network. Here's Brian Kilmeade with Dr. Oz.
I'm going to see what you thought about this. Britt Hume said last night that there's a chance that the mitigation efforts of this lockdown have been a colossal public policy calamity, and the damage to the economy, to businesses that are closing, many are not going to reopen. The damage is to kids who don't have their normal lives and can't go to school outstrip, my words, the benefit of shutting the country down. Is that a possibility that it has been a colossal error?
I don't think so. But also, who would want to gamble with that many American lives? We saw what happened in New York when we shut the state down, when Governor Cuomo made that decision, and the same thing happened here in New Jersey. The numbers of cases that had been afflicted was tiny compared to what it is now. And we realized pretty quickly that you have a lot of lagging indicators when you're trying to predict the future in that setting. I don't think that gamble was worth taking, and who knows how many Americans would have perished. Now, we don't want to do it again. And that's why some of the insights in the CDC Opening America guidelines are so critical we adhere to. Because if we're sloppy about this, we will lose American lives, but also we'll lose the confidence of the American people. But we're better than that. I know we can make this happen. The game plan is pretty, and the blueprint is pretty clear.
Yeah, there's Brian Kilmeade trying to push this narrative. I mean, here's the other thing that people don't appreciate. We have 70% of the country now is saying, like, yeah, I don't want to rush this. You can open up the furniture store, but people aren't going to necessarily go in and buy a new couch if they think that they're risking their lives in doing so. And certainly in some parts of the country, people have been completely untouched by this. They see it only on TV. And so they assume it can't be a problem and they'll go in. But broadly speaking, the folks need confidence to go back into the stores, and there's nothing different. The virus has not changed. Just because we all stayed inside for a couple of weeks, the virus doesn't say, like, well, I guess it's just whatever. It's still there. Like Dr. Oz said, I can't believe I'm quoting him, but the bottom line is, even after starting the social distancing in New York, started March 13th, I guess had it started March 1st, you would have been able to avoid the over 10,000 deaths that we've had there. But how do you know? We certainly won't know that, oh, shouldn't have opened up those set of retail outlets. I mean, this is what we're going to start to see, is we're going to see it opening up, and there's no feedback that's going to happen quick enough to get a sense of, have we opened up too much or too little, until we get testing. Apparently, the only place in the country that's going to have a decent number of tests is going to be, was it Maryland? Is that where Hogan's from? Or is it Delaware? I always get those two confused. Because, his wife had some connections in South Korea, so they flew it in directly. Probably did not tell the federal government. Trump was pissed. Was supposed to run those through some subsidiary of Jared's or something. Hey, folks, for companies, governments, and even individuals, managing the ever-evolving cyber threat landscape can be the difference between thriving and being thwarted. Afternoon Cyber Tea with Ann Johnson has insights for CISOs and key decision makers striving to succeed amid rapid change without compromising security. Each week, Ann Johnson, Corporate Vice President for Cybersecurity Solutions at Microsoft, talks with cybersecurity thought leaders and influential industry experts to explore perspectives on implementing new tech, next generation security risks, current trends, the future state of cybersecurity, all of it. Join Ann as she and her guests explore the risk and promise of tools and systems powered by AI, IoT, machine learning, and other emerging technology, as well as the impact on how humans work, how they communicate, consume information, and live in this era of digital transformation. I'll say, I wonder how many people are going to go back to work after this, as opposed to working at home. Look, it's not enough to keep up with cyber criminals. You need to stay a step ahead. Afternoon Cyber Tea is available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One. Listen in to lead the future of security. And folks, listen, nobody knows more than I that it's hard to sit down and find time to read when it is not, you know, a children's book that you're reading to your child. And even then, if it lasts for more than 15 minutes, I fall asleep. It's all workbooks for me, but I've talked to you about this before. There's an amazing app. It's called Blinkist. It's going to be your new secret weapon for learning new things, for bettering yourself, and for getting a grasp of certain ideas that are out there, certain timelines. Because Blinkist takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, condenses them down just to 15 minutes that you can read or listen to on your phone, on your tablet, on your computer browser, your web browser, the internet. Blinkist is made for busy people who want to get to the main points of book quickly, or for people who are busy or not busy and just don't want to invest a huge amount of time in a book that they feel like they just need the main takeaways. That's what it is for me. And you could do this during your commute. You can do it during your lunch break. You can do it during your exercise. You can do it in the 15 minutes that you're able to lock your kids out of your room. For me, I have made the decision that based upon my having to now do homeschooling for my kids, I am going to listen or read. I'll probably do both. I'll do one will be listen, one will be read, or I don't know how I'll break it up. But they've got Learn Better by Ulrich Boser, Ultra Learning by Scott Young, and Fluent in 3 Months by Benny Lewis. I don't know anything about those books, but all I'm going to have to do to get all of the main points of those books is to invest less than 45 minutes. Are you kidding me? Boom. With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books, all for one low price. For a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer for just our audience. So you can check out one of my faves, The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss. And I think I'm going to read The American Carnage on the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump by Tim Alberta. Look, I'm not terribly interested in hearing about all that stuff, but I'll take the key takeaways from that book. Maybe there's a story or two I wouldn't have known. Maybe I'll end up reading the book. For a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer for just our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/Majority Report. Try it for free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, BLINKIST.com/Majority Report to start your 7-day free trial and then save 25% off of your new subscription. Sign up now at Blinkist.com/Majority Report. All right, quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Charlotte Alter, national correspondent for Time, on her new book, The Ones We've Been Waiting For, How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Charlotte Alter. She's a national correspondent for Time Magazine, author of The Ones We've Been Waiting For, How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. Welcome to the program, Charlotte.
Thanks so much for having me. So excited to be here.
Well, I'm very excited to have you here too, actually, because I am sort of... As a Gen Xer, generation is completely neglected in the discourse of our society, and I would say with good reason, as far as I'm concerned. I am sort of fascinated by all the changes that are taking place, and am convinced that much of this has to do with sort of like just the structure of generations. But we will talk about that. Your book, you do a story, you essentially write, views of 10 politicians who are millennials and the events that sort of define who they are and presumably the millennial generation. Let's just start with this. What is a millennial?
Great question. So millennials were born between 1981 and 1996. So what I did for this book was at a certain point in 2017, I woke up and looked around and realized that our government was being led, was a government of old people by old people and for old people. And we had the oldest first term president elected by graying white voters. Enabled and encouraged by a Congress full of octogenarians. And I basically realized this is not going to last forever. There is a generational shift on the horizon. And so then I kind of set out to figure out what that generational shift might look like. And so I was specifically looking at elected leaders who fell into that age range, born between 1981 and 1996. So that included some familiar names like AOC and Pete Buttigieg, who I talked, both of them, I talked to them extensively for this book. People you might recognize from impeachment, like Elise Stefanik. I tried to make it bipartisan. Lauren Underwood is a Democrat who won a seat in Illinois. But there are also some people in here who you might not recognize who are, you know, operating on the state and local level. And I figured it was important to include them too, because today's state senators are tomorrow's members of Congress and next week's senators. So it's important to kind of look a little bit beyond just the people who are the bold-faced names.
I wanted to hold off on this question, but I just can't help myself. Like, why skip to that generation? Right. I mean, that is the sort of the fascinating, I think, sort of dynamic that's going on here.
So, you know, I didn't really mean for this book to be a skip of Gen X. You know, it's like I would love for somebody to write the Gen X book. I would be the first person to read it, you know? And this book is, you know, certainly we're going to see, not certainly, I think we're probably going to see a Gen X president, like, you know, people in Gen X are like Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, Cory Booker are all in that age group. It seems pretty likely that they are the people who are, you know, next in terms of higher office. But what we are seeing, and the point that I make in the book, is that right now millennials are because they are new to the scene and because they represent this kind of new dynamic force in American politics, they're having more impact on the conversation than Gen Xers who've already been around for a while. And
Without a doubt. I mean, overwhelmingly so. But the thing is,
yeah,
Gen X never had that. I mean, I guess that's what I'm trying to get at. I'm not defensive about this at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't write a book about Gen X. Why would you?
Yeah.
There's nothing interesting happening there.
Yeah. So one thing that I, you know, learned in doing a lot of research about generations for this book is that essentially there are big generations and little generations. And there are some generations that, I'm trying to be careful about this because some of the research on this is a little bit dubious and kind of like overgeneralized. So right. I try to kind of talk about it without like, you know, really giving it too much credence because it's really hard to talk about an entire generation of people. Right.
Sure,
but there is some kind of theory on this that basically says that some generations are more like outward facing and civic and more about engaging with the structures of the world, like government and policy and things like that. And other generations are a little bit more inward focused and focused on things like spirituality and art and music and, you know, like dealing with the inner world and less focused on sort of the public realm. And obviously there are many, many huge exceptions. You can list them off the top of your head. But, you know, one possibility is that these bigger generations, like the greatest generation, the baby boomers, the millennials, tend to be a little bit more like, we're here, we're taking over, like, it's our turn now. And the generations in between, which are, by the way, just smaller, like there are, we're just
physically smaller. We're just talking about there's less people being born during a certain era. And that's basically it.
Exactly. Because what we're seeing because these generations I just listed, the greatest generation, the baby boomers, and then the millennials, that's like a reverberated baby boom. Right. So there were just a ton of people and in some ways, the generations that are in between Gen X and the silent generation, which is people born in like the 1930s who were kind of kids during World War II and didn't really serve in World War II, but they were alive then, but they were maybe, you know, 10 or 11 years old. Like those, there are just fewer people like that. Those were less fertile times. If you look at the demographics, it goes a little bit like, you know, it's like a little bit, it looks hilly kind of. And you have a spike with, you know, obviously after World War II, there was a baby boom and a bunch of kids were born. And then the millennials are the kids of those kids.
Right. And so, I mean,
does that make sense?
Oh yes, totally. I mean, my theory is simply that the size of the generation dictates their influence on culture. Both because they have the buying power and because if a generation like the boomers, there's so many of them that, you know, after the boomers have had their turn, more boomers are there to take another turn. And then more boomers are there to take a turn. And they're eating up our turn in terms of the Gen Xers. And then all of a sudden, like our day has passed, we're too old to be relevant. And I'm not just talking about myself, I'm just saying this generally.
Absolutely. And like, listen, the idea that the boomers have held on for too long, like definitely, that is definitely true. And I think you're right that there is a sense of like holding on and holding on. And then at a certain point, it's almost like the Prince Charles problem, where now he's been waiting for his turn for so long that he's not going to be a fresh faced young leader. You know, he's going to kind of take over from a position of has been this. But I also think that there is a lot of what I talk about in the book is that generations are not really defined. You know, obviously they are effectively defined by age factually, but what we're talking about when we talk about a generation is a cohort of people who have a similar set of shared experiences and a similar context in which they see the world, right? And that context is determined by the major historical events of the times in which they lived. So for example, this is why arguments about socialism tend to fall along generational lines, and why when boomers like start, you know, spewing arguments about the Soviet Union and Russian aggression and things like that, like millennials' eyes glaze over and they're like, what are you talking about? Because they didn't live through the Cold War. They don't remember it at all. The oldest millennials were 9 when the Berlin Wall fell, right? So they have a totally different context for viewing some of these events and ideas. And I think you're totally right that the more people you have in that cohort who share that kind of, who share the same sensibilities and share the same context and lens through which they're viewing the world, the more powerful that lens becomes.
I want to get to the specifics of your book, but this part of the conversation is fascinating to me, because I agree totally with what you're saying about the, you know, the wall fell in, what was it, 91, I guess, and the idea of socialism means, you know, as being something spooky, it means nothing to people who were, you know, 10 at that age. Although, with that said, Vietnam happened, you know, we didn't leave Vietnam until I was 6. And Vietnam dominated all conversations between age 20 and 30 for me politically. Like, that was all about, it was all about, you know, Bill Clinton, and it was all about how George Bush, we were getting past the Vietnam syndrome and this and that. And I think that's just another example of the boomers still dominating, you know, well beyond their capacity. And had, I think, Gen X been bigger, we still would have, might have had something to say about that. But I mean, really, you know, I mean, I've had this conversation with Gen Xers. It's very rare that I find someone who's my age who hid under their desk. It's just, it was like the last time where that happened. Anybody just slightly younger than me. And I'm on one end of Gen X, but, all right. So let's get to, more of the specifics, because I'm really interested about a couple of these people. You start with 9/11. And I guess just talk about how 9/11 informs millennials' perspective.
So one of the things, so 9/11, I start the book on 9/11 because it was, for many of these young people, one of the first big geopolitical historical moments that they remember, right? They weren't alive for when JFK was assassinated. They weren't around for the fall of the Berlin Wall. They didn't live through World War II. This was the first moment that they, oftentimes as young as 12, I mean, AOC was in seventh grade when this happened, you know, began to think of America's role in the world. And 9/11 also was a really important turning point in the way, frankly, that I think coronavirus is going to be also, in terms of the world was divided into before 9/11 and after 9/11 in terms of the U.S. foreign policy posture, in terms of how people within the United States thought about national security and also thought about each other, in terms of whether people thought of the United States as a benign force for good in the world, which was something that had been discussed over and over. But now with the war on terror, like, there was new doubt cast on whether, you know, American foreign interference was moral or not. And so I think that, you know, the reason I started the book on 9/11 is that millennials grew up in that aftermath. And there are very few millennials who really kind of developed their political ideology before 9/11. It was like it was in some ways the starting point for them. And I actually think coronavirus is going to be a very similar starting point for Gen Z. You know, the thing, I think the rule of thumb for this is that kids, young children, or even teenagers, really, you know, generally are not paying, unless they're already activists and happen to be really politically active, kids are not paying that much attention to what goes on in Washington. They can't vote. They're not paying taxes. You know, most kids are not following it closely. The things that get kids' attention and the things that really wake kids up are the things that get school canceled, right?
Right.
And that's why, you know, you don't ever hear, I mean, you would have to be like a really unusual kid to say like, well, when, you know, when Barack Obama, you know, negotiated the Iran deal, like that was a big moment for me. Like that's very rare, right? But school shootings, kids remember those. Big hurricanes that, you know, that cancel school in New Orleans or in New York, kids remember those. 9/11, kids remember that. And coronavirus is going to be another thing like that. So I think for millennials, this was just the first big moment where a lot of these young people thought, hey, I'm living through something that is actually a part of history, and now I'm a part of it too.
I want to circle back to the coronavirus thing, because actually that was one of the things I wanted to ask you as to how that's going to impact how you know, Z's reaction to millennials may shape what millennials end up doing. But so you did look at there's a couple of people I want to talk about that
sure.
that I'm really curious about. I mean, you talk to AOC, you talk to Myrick, who is the mayor of Ithaca, Braxton Winston, who is a member of the city council in Charlotte. But I'm really interested in the ones that are sort of contrary to the way that we perceive millennials on some level. So like Buttigieg, at least in terms of the way that he tried to portray himself, and Crenshaw and Stefanik. Those are the ones that really sort of fascinate me. So let's start with Buttigieg.
Yeah.
When did you start, when did you start covering Buttigieg, or I guess, you know, start to track his story?
So I started covering Buttigieg in 2017. So long before he was running for president, because, you know, essentially the first iteration of this book was a story I wrote in 2017 about millennial mayors. And it was about, you know, what happens when millennials take over American cities? You know, what changes? You know, what do they do to the, what do they do to the environmental development in that city? How do they handle housing? What, you know, do they update municipal technology? Things like that. So he, so I talked to him for a while for that story. And we kept in touch, and I could tell even back then, I could tell that he was angling for something bigger, right?
Well, he had run for DNC at that point, right? By 2017?
He was running for DNC chair, but by the time I talked to him, it was pretty clear it wasn't going anywhere.
Right.
Like, you know?
Right.
So I could tell that he was angling for something bigger. And we kept in touch, and, you know, I dropped in on him in 2018. We drove around, South Bend together, you know, like he drove me around in his little sedan that was full of galleys of his book, and we had tacos, and, you know, like it was like we were hanging out just like normal people, not like journalist and presidential candidate. Although obviously I was obviously a journalist writing a book about him, which he knew, but, you know, and so then it was really interesting to see him kind of transform over the course of 2019 into this presidential candidate. And the thing that I found the most interesting about him is that a lot of the things that millennials in particular hate about Pete Buttigieg, that they think he feels inauthentic, they think he feels practiced, they think he's like Mr. Goody Goody who like never says the wrong thing, and he's like, you know, too kind of polished. That he is exactly the guy that I saw in 2017 and 2018. And I talked to literally everybody who's ever met him. I talked to his mother. I talked to his college roommates. I talked to his friends from middle school and elementary school. I talked to people who knew him when he was 2 years old. Like, everybody says the same thing about him, that that's just what he's like. That's his personality. It's not like
inauthentic.
A show. Yes. And I think that the key fact to remember here is that this is a guy who lived in the closet in a conservative part of Indiana where he knew no other gay people for 33 years of his life.
I think that's very astute. I think that is a characteristic, I think, that was much more common amongst gay folks in my age cohort and older.
Because
being in a small town changes that dynamic. I mean, it's a lagging, I think, experience for people.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, if you are gay in a community where you don't feel like you can be open about your sexuality, it creates this, from a very young age, he was very conscious of how he presented in the world. He was very scripted. He was very on guard. So that guardedness that people sense about him, that I think a lot of millennials like read as fakeness, it actually isn't fake. It's a personality that he's developed from being in the closet for 33 decades of his life. But the other thing that I want to say about Pete Buttigieg, which I think is really interesting, is that in this presidential election, obviously, he was in the moderate lane, right? But in some ways, looking at somebody like Pete Buttigieg shows just how he is in some ways a bellwether for just how far millennials have pulled the Democratic Party to the left, right? Because the left is always going to be asking for the most left-wing thing, right? That's why they're the left. But Pete Buttigieg, again, a moderate, was asking for a public option on healthcare, massive government help with student loan forgiveness, massive government investment on climate change that included a ton of job creation. Those were all things that the Democratic Party in the 1990s never would have asked for, right?
I mean, for a centrist, in the aughts. I mean, 10 years ago, the Democratic Party would have never asked for.
Exactly. Right. So in some ways, somebody like Pete Buttigieg, you know, if you know he's in the center, like measuring where Pete Buttigieg is, can help us understand how far the center of gravity has shifted. Like, obviously he's still getting all this hate from progressives for not going further than he has. But in some ways, like, even though he's not the AOC and he's not the conversation driver for millennial progressives, he's an example of how successful they've been because if he's the up and coming young moderate, like, that's a lot of progress that they've made compared to moderates of previous generations.
Right. If Pete Buttigieg is the right side of the Democratic Party going forward, that is indicative of huge leaps forward, without a doubt. And I think one of the things I like about millennials is that they don't necessarily, broadly speaking, appreciate that. And so they are relentless in pursuing more. I mean, that's one of the things I like about millennials in that respect. All right. So let's talk about, let's move to the right. And I guess presumably it's Stefanik who's next, but she's actually sort of the more interesting to me than Crenshaw. So let's go to Crenshaw next. Because he's just sort of, I feel like Crenshaw could be more or less 20 years older and it wouldn't make a difference in terms of how he presents. Would it, or am I wrong?
I think you're right. I think yes and no. I mean, I do think the fact that he is a Afghanistan veteran makes a huge difference. Like, he's somebody who's very much of the wars that this generation fought. You know, I don't think that a Vietnam veteran would have the same kind of traction that he has right now.
Right.
And listen, those were wars that were fought by millennials, by and large, and some Gen Xers too. But they were defining wars for the millennial generation for the reasons I just described with 9/11. Right. He's somebody who's really interesting because he in some ways represents the reaction. You know, like, listen, so when people talk about millennial politics, they tend to talk about AOC and Bernie Sanders and the Squad. And obviously that's covered in the book. There's a lot of that. You know, AOC is one of the main characters. I talked to her for a while about, you know, but I think that people tend to assume that like all millennials are like that. Right. And in some ways, Dan Crenshaw was interesting and honestly really frustrating because it was it was interesting to see how much of his defense of Donald Trump was actually not about agreeing with Donald Trump. It was about hating the anti-Trump left. So it wasn't pro-Trump, it was anti-anti-Trump. It kind of opened up a lot about, and it revealed a lot about how, even though there has been this vigorous anti-Trump resistance that's been, you know, working alongside with this millennial progressive movement and a push for more social safety nets and a, you know, redefinition of what socialism could mean in the United States and all of these kind of, things that in the mainstream media and in the left-wing space seem to be like big steps forward, right? I don't think that very many progressives understand the extent to which there is a backlash to that, even among millennials, that will endure even when Trump is no longer president and even when this kind of old guard is gone. So I thought that was really interesting that he's pretty critical of Trump, not as critical as other people, obviously.
Right.
But it's mostly a reaction to what he perceives as like an overly sanctimonious left.
But I will say this, and this is my point. That is not in any way a defining feature of the right in terms of millennials, in terms of generational, because you can go back and read blogs from 2006 and the concept that conservatives believe in nothing except for being against what the libs at that time were for was all over the place. I mean, in fact, I was on a show with Whitman, Christy Todd Whitman, in 2011, who told me that the reason why Republicans were not on board with the concept of climate change was because liberals were so in your face about it. That's the fascinating thing to me about a guy like Crenshaw. There is no difference between Crenshaw's, what Crenshaw's saying and what Rush Limbaugh was saying 15, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. It was all their positions were always a function of, to own the libs, essentially. Mm-hmm. And that dynamic is enduring on the right. Like, that's the thing, is that he's not reacting as a conservative, as a millennial who's conservative. He's acting as a conservative who happens to be a millennial.
Like, exactly. I think you're totally right. And listen, not every aspect of millennial conservative politics or millennial politics in general is wholly new, right? Like, it's not like they're inventing an entirely new political discourse out of whole cloth. Like, obviously they are taking strains of what have defined these movements before and updating them. I think that what is different about Crenshaw, and one of the reasons why he's somebody who is politically skilled and, you know, has a future in a way that might scare some, you know, people who oppose him, is that he's able to own the libs in a way that is funny and disarming to them and totally negates their argument, but not mean in the way that Trump is. Trump does it in a really mean way, and Crenshaw doesn't do it in a nice way at all, but he's not quite as like cruel as Trump is, or he doesn't present as cruel as Trump is, and he's able to utilize the internet in a way, in a very similar way that AOC does, right, where he, on his Instagram stories, will, you know, like, you're totally right that the impulse is the same. The owning the libs impulse is not a new thing, but he's been able to kind of update it tonally in a way that is very appealing for a lot of young conservatives who may be like, you know, got to campus and don't know why they have to now be saying their pronouns at the beginning of every class, right? So he's kind of capturing that, that sort of like disaffected conservative impulse that's always been there, but he's making it not like, like those kids aren't going to go listen to Rush Limbaugh, you know? Rush Limbaugh is not getting like 18-year-old kids to go listen to him.
Well, but they're listening. They're listening to the people who basically learned at Limbaugh's knee. They're listening to Ben Shapiro. Yeah. They're listening to Eric Erickson. These are all people who worshipped Limbaugh and came from that school. I mean, this is, I mean, that's why I think like Stefanik is more interesting to me, or was. I mean, I think she, you know, she's been overtaken, but Stefanik was someone who was actually trying to break from the orthodoxy of the right, it seems to me. And we should say she's a congresswoman, but I think it's from the 21st district up in New York. It is a maybe 70%, 65% rural district, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And
it's extremely rural, yeah.
And she was trying to break, I mean, even from that context, right, was trying to break from, I think, the orthodoxy in a way that I don't perceive Crenshaw was. She ultimately, I think, failed. But tell us about Stefanik, because you had finished writing about her before I think she really basically, you know, saw like, okay, I have only one path. But go ahead.
Right. So that was one of the trickiest parts of writing this book, is that, you know, I finished, so the book came out in February. I finished writing it, you know, like it has to go to the presses a couple months before, right? So I finished writing it in November. And it was literally like I could not make any more changes. And I knew that the president was going to be facing impeachment. I didn't know what was going to happen. Elise Stefanik was making these noises about being one of the president's biggest defenders, but I couldn't write about that because it hadn't happened yet. You know, so I had to kind of write it in this very subtle way to sort of hint at something looming in the future, basically. But Elise Stefanik's evolution is a really interesting one. So she... there was, during the Obama era, this cohort of young, moderate Republicans who basically saw the writing on the wall with the Republican Party, especially after Romney's loss, right? So she had worked for George W. Bush and she worked for Romney. She is like a hardcore old school Republican, right? And she basically decided, you know, that, so the Republican Party in general had, you know, published this now famous autopsy, which basically said, if we don't get more young people, women, and people of color into the Republican Party, we're going to have big problems. And now everyone laughs at that autopsy because then immediately afterwards, Trump was elected. But actually, in the long term, that autopsy was right. And Elise Stefanik was one of this cohort of young Republicans who was really trying to move the Republican Party in that direction, to recruit more women, to get more Hispanics and people of color into the party, to make it more appealing to young people, to not be the party of climate change denial, you know, to not be the party of racism, right? And I think that she and others in that little cohort were very aware of trying to update the Republican Party's brand in a way that might appeal to young people who didn't want to go as far left as the Democrats were going, but also believed in climate science because, like, duh, you know? And so for a while, you know, before Trump, she was not on the Trump train in 2016. She's, by the way, Elise Stefanik is an extremely skilled politician, extremely ambitious, extremely good at her job, and extremely sophisticated and careful about what she's doing. And the reason for that, I think, is that She's somebody who is very ambitious. She wants to go very far in politics, and she's a Republican in New York State, which means that she is most likely, you know, it's going to be very hard for her to win statewide. It's going to be very hard for her to win a governor's seat. It's going to be very hard for her to win a Senate seat. So her path upwards is to move up within the Republican Party in the House and make it to House leadership, which it now seems like a very clear path for her, right? You know, she's doing very well in the party. She absolutely could make that happen. But that meant that she is more attuned to where the Republican Party itself is going than, you know, if she was, for example, a Republican in Michigan or in Wisconsin or in Tennessee, where she had a lot of other options for what she could run for. Because it's a state that is where Republicans do better, right?
So she's a weather vane for where the Republicans are headed.
Yes, but also she's an example of what could have been had the Republican Party not elected Trump, because there was this period where these young Republicans were getting together and saying, like, listen, let's provide a millennial Republican alternative to the Republican Party right now. Let's move the party into the 21st century. And Trump just totally nuked that. And now, one of the most surprising things I found out when I was, and honestly, that has, you know, Trump is the reason why the Republican Party is doing so badly with young people. I mean, half of young Republicans defected from the party from 2015 to 2017. So over the course of Trump's rise, and then half of those went back, you know, and a quarter left.
But
a quarter defected permanently, and a quarter had like a shaky alliance where they left and then they came back.
Can I push back on one concept here?
Sure.
And that is, I think it's actually it's not that Trump has changed the trajectory of the Republican Party. I really think it was that Trump was the trajectory of the Republican Party. I like the idea that, you know, at least may have had these ideas of what could have been, but she would have lost to the Dan Crenshaws. She would have lost to the, I mean, the reason why Donald Trump exists is not because he was, you know, dropped down from a spaceship. The Republican Party was headed in this direction. I mean, it was headed in, this was the Donald Trump was the culmination of the Republican Party. He was not in any way a divergence from where they were going. It's just that I think to a large extent, people were just not in touch with what was driving the Republican Party. And it was all on talk radio. And it was, and George Bush knew it in 2005 when he tried to do immigration reform. He found out that he was the Republican Party that he thought existed was not there. And I think to a large extent, and also with Harriet Myers and whatnot, I mean, I think they were trying in 2005 to make that pivot and for the sake of the Republican Party. And I think he and Karl Rove found out like, we're too late. The ball is rolling in this direction. I mean, and they were largely at least in part responsible for it. So, but I just don't think that absent Trump, the Stefaniks would have been able to follow the path that they were, that they may have wanted to. I think they would have lost. It wouldn't have been to Trump. Maybe it would have been to Tom Cotton. Maybe it would have been to Ted Cruz. But I just don't think that, and because frankly, anybody else in that field would have lost to Hillary Clinton. And all that would have happened with the Republican Party is they would have moved further to, you know, wherever Trump was. Maybe some of the specifics would be different. Maybe they'd be pretending that they cared about the deficit at this point. But I think she was doomed. I think what we saw with her with Trump and this turn was inevitable. It may have looked a little bit different, but that turn was inevitable. There's no room for that in the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly, she was tiptoeing that line for a while. I mean, what I would say is that I think that this is, and this is why, you know, people always ask me, well, what does your book mean for the next election, right? And the truth is, this isn't a book about any particular election or who would have won the presidency in 2016 or 2020 or 2024. It's about the broader trends of where, of like, if we know that nobody lives forever, right? And we know that the younger generation coming up, according to polls, broadly believe in climate change, broadly believe in racial equity, broadly believe in women's rights, broadly, support immigration reform of some kind, broadly are struggling with student debt, right? We know that those things are true. I think what she was trying to do, which I think you're right, she failed at, and I think there's a debate to be had about whether she was doomed to fail, was that she was trying to say, okay, well, given that we know this about the up and coming generation, what are going to be the conservative solutions to those problems? We're always going to be Republicans, but we have to be, instead of fighting the battles of the past, like fighting over marriage equality and whether, you know, same-sex couples can get married, which is totally a battle of the past that the millennial Republican Party is not at all concerned with relitigating. She and people like Carlos Curbelo and this very small handful of millennial Republicans were like, okay, we are conservatives. We are small government conservative Republicans, you know, but we see the writing on the wall. We know that people our age care about these set of things. What are going to be our small government conservative solutions to those problems? And I think what Trump did was he just kind of dialed everything back to the 1990s. And he was trying to, you know, fight old fights and pick old wounds and inflame old resentments. And I think that you're right that definitely worked, obviously. But I do think that as time goes on, you know, there are going to be fewer, you know, 10 years from now, there aren't going to be a lot of people who are that interested in relitigating, you know, Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky in the way that Bill Clinton's sex affairs were, you know, something that became a big issue in the 2016 election. And so that's kind of the gist of this book, is that, you know, things are moving forward. This too shall pass. There is a new generation with a new set of attitudes that's informed by the historical events of their lifetime. And, you know, the political debates of the future will be more about that than they are about what happened in the 1990s and the early aughts.
Well, I will make a prediction of my own, and it's somewhat facetious, but it's going to be that for that generation, it will be an argument as to whether Kamala Harris was actually born in this country. In the event that she ends up as VP. I mean, I think that is, you know, as much as the Clintons certainly were implicated in the past, you know, 5 or 6 years, the fact that Barack Obama was an African American in office, I think, was sort of a stalwart feature of the right in this country. I mean, John Boehner refused to censure a half a dozen of his people in his caucus who were raising legislation about the president being born in this country. And there's no reason why theoretically he shouldn't have been able to say, yeah, those five guys shouldn't do this, unless that was a representative of something bigger that was happening in that party. But I think it's a fascinating look at a generation that I can't wait to get in power. And I'm also, it's going to be curious, like you say, to see how this lesson, I have a 14-year-old daughter, and I think she's certainly going to understand that we are connected in a way that I think generations prior to hers haven't. And that's going to dovetail nicely, I think, with the push from where the energy is in this generation, which is to pushing more communitarian policies for our government. But Charlotte, thank you so much for your time. The book
Thanks so much for having me.
The ones we've been waiting for, How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. We will put a link at majority.fm. Charlotte Alter, thanks again for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break in just a moment, head to the fun half. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. We've had this is a very difficult time for people, and we have lost some members, and we have some people who are stepping up. Very much appreciated. Obviously, things from an advertising end, not great, not apocalyptic, but things on YouTube are a little bit tricky, and we're working on trying to figure out maybe how we deal with that, but it is ultimately our members who make this show possible. You can become one by going to jointhemajorityreport.com, and we have a number of different payment options there now, and Kyle has been working the back end. Things are going quite well in that regard. Also, you know, of course, we have the app. You can check that out, majorityapp.com. Sign up for the AM Quickie. You can subscribe for free. It's on iTunes, or you can see it on our YouTube channel. You can get it on Stitcher, wherever. Check it out. We're hoping, you know, to sell some advertising against that. If there are people who are out there who are advertising, hopefully that will come about. And again, if you are someone who wants the fun half and you don't have the financial means, or you're worried about your job, or you have any type of financial stress, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will hook you up. Just have a little patience. Sometimes it takes us a little while to dig stuff out, but we will get to it, I promise you. Also, check out TMBS tonight, live on YouTube.com, The Michael Brooks Show. Check it out at patreon.com/TMBS.
Cornel West, folks.
Cornel West is on tonight.
Live tonight.
Exciting. Yep. Very exciting. Not in studio, of course.
Nope. Yeah.
That's good.
Michael's going to break social distancing by having Cornel West come over.
Cornel West on TMBS tonight, so check that out.
She's on the line. Do you want me to bring her on?
Yeah. Namiki, come on. Right. In the meantime, check out the Antifada, patreon.com/theAntifada. Nomiki's going to join me in the fun half, but Nomiki, what's on par for the Nomiki show?
Hi, that was quick. what's on par for the Nomiki show? Oh, this week's really juicy. We have David Sirota, that interview just posted after his little Twitter debacle with other senior staffers from the Bernie Sanders campaign. We try to get to the bottom of that. What's going on over there? It's all about power, how we utilize our power as a movement right now. I mean, we could sit here and we could assess the past and point fingers and blame, but that's kind of what they want us to do, is to divide ourselves up so we can lose progress for another generation or two, which of course we don't have time for. So the show is very much focused on power, how to organize, how to keep solidarity and not let the right wing and the neoliberals divide us. So that's pretty much the next two episodes. Every single guest we have on is going to illustrate that.
Sweet. And yeah. Matt, what's happening on Literary Hangover, or the Literary Hangover Twitch stream?
Well, in preparation for the next Literary Hangover proper episode on Daniel Defoe's A Journal of the Plague Year, which is a 1722 fictional narrative about, you know, living through a plague, I'm going to play.
Can you imagine?
Appropriate.
I am going to be playing A Plague's Tale: Innocence, a video game that has you living through a plague. So it's very appropriate stuff, folks. It's going to be the next few nights on Twitter. Probably not tonight because we got TMBS tonight. But next few days, I'll be twitching that. I'll be playing the game while listening to that.
Wasn't that what Doom was about?
Doom.
What was that game? Doom.
I don't know. The new Doom doesn't have many plague elements, at least.
I feel like that was a biohazard.
I think that's what Frogger was about.
Doom, biohazard.
I'm not a gamer, but I know.
This stuff is really coming back to me.
Yeah. Nice haircut, Sam.
Thank you. Yes, I appreciate that.
Did you do it?
Well, my daughter and I did it. She took this divot out of the side of my head, and then I
sort of did the rest. All right, we're going to take a quick break to the fun half. We'll be right back in a moment.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.